DHHS Commissioner Jean Lambrew. Maine's Department of Health and Human Services is by far the biggest state agency, with 3,400 employees and a $3.4 billion budget. Most of the state's safety net services fall under its jurisdiction, including MaineCare, the state's psychiatric facilities, general assistance, child welfare, elder protection, and more. The department is a flashpoint for some of the state's most controversial and difficult issues. Most recently, its handling of child welfare cases after the deaths of two children. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Jean Lambrew has been on the job for about 2 months now and has already overseen the expansion of Medicaid, filled empty DHHS positions, and announced a plan to keep more children safe. What are your questions for her? Maine Calling is next. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Augusta, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The Department of Health and Human Resources, Health and Human Services is the state's largest agency. It covers some of the most critical areas facing our state and has a budget in excess of $3 billion. It's important, and the first cabinet appointment by Governor Mills was the Secretary of DHHS, Jean Lambrew, the Commissioner of DHHS, Jean Lambrew. She was sworn in to lead Maine's Department of Health and Human Services in February. Before that, she was a senior fellow at the Century Foundation and taught at the NYU Graduate School of Public Service. She has worked in many key health policy positions in the federal government, including to help shape the Affordable Care Act as director of health reform under President Obama. She grew up in Cape Elizabeth. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have for Commissioner Lambrew? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thanks so much for joining us on Maine Calling, Commissioner. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up back here in Maine.
Oh, well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's not only exciting to be on the show, but it's absolutely thrilling to be back in Maine. I grew up here, as you noted, and when I was growing up, I had a mother who is a nurse and a father who's a doctor, and they oftentimes were talking about the system problems in the state, the challenges that nurses and doctors face that are beyond their control. So when I was in college, I did an internship for the state, went to graduate school in public health, and was going to try to come back to Maine, but got diverted to Washington, D.C., where I worked on health reform in the Clinton and the Obama White House.
So, and you helped develop the Affordable Care Act, correct?
I did. I worked on it from the first to the last day of the Obama administration.
Wow. Governor Mills has said that it is a priority of hers to, quote, reinvigorate morale at the Department of Health and Human Services. How are you doing that?
Well, the governor has given us a great start, which is to change some of the process that made it harder for people to get their jobs done. So, for example, she no longer requires every single job vacancy to go to the governor's office for approval, which has meant that in the first couple of months at the department alone, we have posted over 200 jobs and filled a whole bunch of them, including 9 public health nurses, which brings the public health nursing corps to 38, which is great. We've also changed the rulemaking process, which means the governor doesn't need to sign off on every single rulemaking. So we begin to move things through faster because she has said, we trust you. Turning to what we're doing, we're trying to listen. We have done activities like a survey of all the workers at the Office of Child and Family Services. I've talked to all the public health nurses, gone to eligibility specialist training sessions. We're trying to get out and listen because the people on the front lines of this department are its heart and soul, and they're the ones who are going to help us fulfill the mission that the department is created to serve.
All right. Only 2 months on the job, but already some big headlines. Last week, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, CMS, approved the state's plan to expand Medicaid. Yet the state has really been enrolling people prior to last week's announcement. So practically speaking, explain how last week's announcement affects what the state is doing going forward.
Well, last week's announcement is just the final stamp of approval on what is a state option. States can expand Medicaid under certain rules, and The first day that Governor Mills was in office, she signed an executive order directing us to file the paperwork, answer the questions, and begin enrollment. So that was on a Thursday. We began enrolling people on a Monday, and we are absolutely thrilled that as of last Friday, 18,129 Mainers have signed up.
18,129. I know the number that has been mentioned over and over again is that 70,000 Mainers are eligible. Do you expect to reach that number, and if so, this year?
So we think we're on target to hit that number by the end of the year. As with every expansion in every state, it takes time. There's always, you know, barriers that you hit along the way. We have lots of applications that we're processing, so we're working our way through this, but we do expect to hit that 70,000. And as a reminder, this is not just about providing uninsured people with coverage. It helps people get earlier diagnoses with cancer. We know from research that the percentage of people with chronic illness getting regular checkups goes up by 11 points. There's been a decline in the adults who have trouble paying bills in states that have expanded Medicaid, and it's good for the economy. We know that uncompensated care, which is the amount of bills or charges that hospitals incur because of uninsured people, drops with Medicaid expansion. And in states that expanded Medicaid, that has dropped by $8.6 billion since 2014. I was to say one more important factor for Maine is it will help our rural hospitals. We know that we have rural hospitals that are struggling to stay open, and that's partly because they have so many uninsured people coming in who now will qualify for Maine care or Medicaid. So we're very excited. It's just the start. We're on track, but we expect that the roughly $800 million that will be coming in from the federal government from January 1st all the way to the next end of the next biennium will be significant in improving health, access, and our economy.
A couple questions. You said processing applications as quickly as possible. How many are sort of in the hopper? How many are waiting to be processed?
There are lots of them. I don't have the count off the top of my head, but we are trying to get a budget initiative that would simplify the system. We do have an online way to get signed up for benefits called My Maine Connection. It's not the easiest system, so we're going to try to simplify that, which should, in the future, make it quicker, easier, while maintaining program integrity for people to sign up for coverage.
And you mentioned $800 million coming in from the federal government. When does that money come in?
It started.
It already did.
We are in the process of, you know, we file our claims with the federal government every quarter, and they will provide us matching payment. We have filed those claims with the federal government, and we expect to get paid.
All right. Well, yesterday, your department outlined new policies to protect children in Maine. And that news release notes that 26 young children in Maine have died in just the last couple years. Two terrible cases that made headlines appeared to be child abuse or neglect. Of those 26 cases, how many of those were child abuse and neglect, and how many were something else?
While privacy considerations and confidentiality laws prevent us from releasing additional information at this point, what we have done is looked at the long-term trends to see what might be driving this. And we've identified two. The first is unsafe sleeping for babies. Since 2014, 45% of child deaths in Maine were related to unsafe sleep environments. What that means is that we want parents to place babies on their back, to sleep on a firm surface free of loose bedding and soft objects, and keep the rooms at comfortable temperature so there's no need for the babies to have blankets near their mouths. So we are encouraging parents, and we're going to do a campaign out of our CDC to encourage more parents to promote these safe sleeping habits. We also know that, sadly, too many of these babies are born to parents with addiction. Recently, a report came out that found that 33% of child abuse victims have parents with active drug abuse disorder, and 18% of those children have a parent with alcohol use disorders. So we are going to try to provide those parents with extra home visits from our public health nursing program, our home visitation program, to make sure that they know what services and supports are there for them to help keep their babies safe.
Talking about the child deaths from sleeping, 40, you said 45%. I'm wondering, is this because so many people keep their homes cold in the winter and they're providing extra blankets to keep their babies warm?
It's a good question. I don't know that we know precisely why it is happening. We do know that, though, that we have opportunities to educate those parents. So, for example, there's a program called Certified Safe Sleep Hospitals, and five of our main hospitals are certified to provide proven education to parents so they know what our best practice is. We're going to try to expand that to all hospitals. We also have programs to try to send cribs into homes. We've sent 850 cribs since the year 2010. Trying to give the child protective system workers a checklist for those parents. So we think that a lot of this is just education. So we're working hard to provide those supports.
Mentioning in relation to the opioid crisis that DHHS will offer extra home visits to vulnerable families, I know that we've read over and over that these caseworkers are really overwhelmed. How is DHHS going to provide extra home visits when the staff is having a hard time just keeping up?
Sure. To be clear, the home visits will be provided by two different programs. One is our public health nursing program, which is run out of the CDC. The other would be the home visitation program that is run out of Office of Child and Family Services. Those people doing those home visits are not the child care caseworkers, the protective services workers. They're different. So we're trying to provide extra help and extra people coming in to support the families, not try to add more work for the child care caseworkers.
Okay. And for the child care caseworkers, for the child protective services, what next for that department?
Sure. Well, we are, from day one, trying to identify challenges and opportunities. We are grateful for the legislature last year providing funding that has allowed us to hire more than 100 staff to fill vacancies, including 82 new caseworkers. We also have been giving child welfare workers what they've been asking for, in part, like background information on individuals when checking to see if there's been abuse and neglect. So we've done a test or a pilot of a background check unit, which has conducted more than 2,100 checks since January 1st, which contributes to the safety of Maine children. We also have hired, and we're very excited, to bring on a national leader to be the first permanent director of the office since 2017. Dr. Todd Landry is coming to Maine, having served in the state of Nebraska and running a nonprofit for children for years. He also is on the board of the Child Welfare League of America. He starts in less than 2 weeks, and we expect him to bring leadership as well as the resources that we're working with the legislature to really build a strong workforce on the backs, and I need to say this, of people in the front lines who are really dedicated. I mean, this is more of a challenge of trying to figure out how do we create the systems to support those child care protective workers who are doing a good job, who want to do a good job. This is not about them not doing a good job. This is about trying to build a system to support them so they can help families keep children safe, reunify when possible, and make sure that there's a permanent solution for those children who are at risk.
I'm curious more about the background check unit. How is that different than what has been the regular operating procedure before?
Our workers have not actually had easy access to any sort of systems to figure out whether or not, you know, the people that they are looking into to keep or to take a child placement have any sort of criminal history. So we've been working with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Department of Corrections, and several other agencies to do this pilot to begin to provide that information in a seamless way to those workers.
So does that mean people who have, for example, applied to be foster parents have not had background checks?
There are background checks. This is giving them information that's often, for example, out of state. Sometimes it's hard to get that out-of-state information. It's doing it quicker, so we have quicker access to that information. So this is ramping up and improving the systems that already are required.
We're talking with the Department of Health and Human Services Commissioner Jean Lambrew. She's been on the job just a couple months now, leading Maine's largest department with 3,400 employees and a budget of more than $3 billion. If you have a question for her, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Maine's mental health facilities have also been in the news. What is the latest in terms of meeting the consent decree to provide adequate mental health services in Maine?
Sure. We are committed to ensuring that people with mental health disorders have access to services in the appropriate setting, including communities. One main goal of that consent decree is indeed to create capacity in communities for people so that they can get care in the most appropriate setting. So we have been working with Judge Waffen, who is the consent decree master, to try to both ensure that we're meeting the obligations that we have as a department, but also to see, are there ways that we can eventually move away from having to have a court order us to make sure that people have the right kind of care. So we've launched on a process to do an assessment of our healthcare, our mental health care system. So we know from the purest base level, what are the preventive services available? What are the primary care services available? And how do we integrate mental health and behavioral health into it? What residential options do people have, as well as what is the need for institutional capacity for those with the severest illness? Our goal is not to have people in inpatient facilities when at all possible. They're needed for some patients, but we're assessing that whole system from ground to top to make sure we know where are gaps, where are strengths, and then how do we make sure individuals get into the right setting at the right time.
As you're doing that assessment, what does that mean for the step-down facility that was so controversial over the last year?
Sure. Governor Mills announced about almost 2 months ago that we looked hard at the building and at the needs in the state of Maine and decided that rather than it being a backdoor for patients who are at the Riverview Psychiatric Center who may not need intense psychiatric care to be in a lesser form of care, we still have some need for inpatient care, in part because many people are inappropriately ending up in prisons and jails who have severe mental illness who might otherwise be cared for. So we have changed the use of that building to be part of Dorothea Dix Psychiatric Center. It will have the same shared staff. We're going to have some efficiencies by having be run by the same group of people under the same medical director. And we expect it will be a complement to Riverview in terms of trying to take on the excess capacity that sometimes comes in the front door of Riverview. All that said, we are simultaneously expanding outpatient capacity at Dorothea Dix, working hard on freeing up resources through these moves to strengthen our community-based options and making sure this is not just an expansion of inpatient capacity. Instead, it is a complement to Riverview in taking some of the hard to handle patients, including those who are otherwise ending up in prisons.
We're speaking with DHHS Commissioner Jean Lambrew. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Waterville Creates, inviting you to learn more about plans for the Downtown Arts Center in Waterville. Details online at downtownartscenter.org.
A new program sends out public alerts when veterans at risk of hurting themselves go missing. But one vet who was found through the system said he felt violated by the experience.
It probably helped find me, but I don't know if it helped me, if that makes sense.
When the right to disappear collides with the desire to save lives. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. Did you know if you do not have cable, it is still possible to see Maine Public Television, all four channels, The World, Create, and Kids as well. In many areas of Maine, you can watch all four of our television signals with an HD TV antenna. Will that work in your neighborhood? We have created a resource to help you answer that question, including finding out the likely signal strength where you live. Go to mainepublic.org for more information, click on Television and Guide for Watching Over the Air, or give us a call at 1-800-884-1717, and we'll send the information right away. With or without cable, Maine Public Television brings you four channels of the highest quality programming, an educational resource not to be missed.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the top issues facing DHHS. Joining me, Commissioner Jean Lambrew. She is Maine's new commissioner of the Department of Health and Human Services. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now, Kim Moody, Executive Director of Disability Rights Maine. Thanks for calling in, Kim.
Well, thanks for having me. Hello, and thanks for talking about disability, and thanks for asking for the advocacy perspective.
So, Kim, before the break, I'm sure you heard us talking a little bit about Maine's mental health system, and the top-down review that's going to happen is in process at DHHS. This is one of your biggest concerns as well, isn't it?
It is. We have deep concerns about the way that services have been delivered for many years, and so we're hoping that the commissioner will help us guide a new way of thinking and help us change assumptions about where people with disabilities should live and where people with disabilities should receive services.
What would you like to see happen in Maine?
I would like to see more in affordable community housing instead of group living. I'd like to see supported apartments. I'd like to see us, and I think we have already begun, stopping the conversation about increasing beds, meaning increasing institutionalization for people with disabilities. I'd like to see us enhance the autonomy of people with intellectual disabilities and developmental disabilities, reduce seclusion and restraint. I'd like to see people with disabilities as decision makers in everything that impacts their lives instead of not being at the tables where decisions are made, which is how it's been for a long time. I'd like to see transportation improved and brain injury services improved. We are spending money on people with disabilities in Maine, but we really, really need to look at how we're spending that money. And so I'm excited to hear about this top-to-bottom look at the mental health system, and I'm really hoping for that same top-to-bottom look on the DD system and ID system, as well as the children's system, because we are, as you know, I think, sending kids out of state again, and we are placing hundreds of kids in more restrictive settings than they need because of a lack of really robust community-based and home-based services and supports that can keep kids in their homes. So that's some of what we'd like to see.
All right. Commissioner Lambrew, before we say goodbye to Kim, anything you would like to say?
I just want to say thank you, because the voices that Kim, Disability Rights, and other groups have brought to the table are invaluable as we're trying to figure out where are the most severe problems, how do we triage. We also share the similar goals of how do we make sure that we keep or get and keep children, adults, seniors in the appropriate settings. And this issue that you raise, I just want to point to about housing. One of the challenges we found is how do you, in a state or in areas like Portland that are very expensive, how do you find the appropriate way to have community-based housing for folks? We were excited that recently we learned that Maine Housing and the department received a grant for technical assistance to begin to look at community living options for Maine Care members, especially those who are homeless and may be experiencing serious and persistent mental illness. So we're trying to not just focus on the medical care part of this, but all those social supports and social determinants of health that will make it possible for people to live independently.
All right. Well, Kim, thanks so much for calling in. Kim Moody, Executive Director of Disability Rights Maine. And now Claire Berkowitz, Executive Director of the Maine Children's Alliance. Thanks for joining us, Claire.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's nice to talk to you both today.
We've discussed the department's response to the child welfare deaths that have been reported. What are the areas that you hope DHHS will prioritize when it comes to child welfare?
Well, we are hopeful in the initial response in light of the 26 deaths, I believe the commissioner stated. And so, you know, home visiting we think is important, and making sure that those families have those types of opportunities to thrive together. We're interested in learning from these deaths in terms of we need to make sure that the children who are in child protection now, who are involved with the system now, are safe. And so we're interested in learning what the department's doing now. Are they taking a review of cases now, either where kids are still in the home and touched by child protection, or in a recently closed case and still in the home? Because that's what we were seeing in some of the data that backed up that Bangor Daily News story, were the number of times the child was touched by the department. And that is one of the findings in DHHS's own data, is that the number one risk factor for a child in a child protective assessment is prior involvement with the department. So that's kind of a long-winded question to ask. What's happening in terms of right now looking at the children who are touched by CPS? How are they being reviewed, and what are we going to do to make sure that no more child dies who's touched by the department?
Well, thank you for that question. We have, as you know, undertaken an intense review of the system. A group called the Public Consulting Group has done an analysis. They came up with 84 recommendations on how to improve the child welfare system. We then took those 84 recommendations and put them to our own workers, our Office of Child and Family Family Services workers, to say, which do you think are most important? And just yesterday posted the top 20 that meets both the experts' recommendations and our own staff's thoughts about what will make children safe and protected and make sure families are healthy. So that's the beginning point for our action plan. We also have been looking at how do people get into the system? What are the referrals like? What is our hotline like? What are the policies and practices that are being used with regard to potentially extra vulnerable children in the homes that we described, and that's an ongoing process. This is not one and done. We are working on this every single day to identify problems and solutions, and we're just committed to making sure that we deploy all resources and all good ideas to ensure that our children are safe.
Claire, the Maine Children's Alliance puts out the annual Kids Count data report. Are there particular findings that you think merit extra attention from the state?
Well, I think some of that is addressed. And infant mortality, for instance, is high in Maine. And I think some of this co-sleeping focus is going to get at that in terms of kids, babies under the age of one who die in their home in a co-sleeping occurrence. I think Maine's teen suicide rate is higher than our national average. We also have data that shows that our teens have more prevalence of anxiety and depression. So I heard Kim talking earlier about the mental health system, and you know, we're very concerned about kids getting the care they need in community-based settings as well. So that's important as well. So there is a lot of work to do in terms of bolstering the health and well-being of our families. I feel like our child welfare and our social safety nets have been quite frayed over the last decade, and there's a lot of rebuilding that needs to be done. And our kids are kind of the canary in the coal mine on that, and our data seems to show that in some instances. We've had an improved economy, and so families are doing better economically, but I think some of the families that haven't been so lucky are still facing a hard climb, and their kids are paying a price.
Yeah, and Claire, to those points, I'll just say quickly that one aspect that we want to focus on is prevention. How do we get to those kids, to those people at risk early through early childhood intervention programs, our CDC trying to get effective suicide prevention campaigns going? We don't want to always be chasing the problems when they're severe. We want to go all the way back upstream to figure out how do we get into schools and workplaces and other settings to make sure that people have the tools to prevent these problems from cycling out of control.
Claire, thanks so much for calling in. Claire Berkowitz, the Executive Director of the Maine Children's Alliance. We'll go to Mike, who's calling in from Portland. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm retired now, but I worked in community mental health for most of my career. And two quick points. One thing is, if you have a physical emergency, you don't end up waiting for a hospital bed. If you have a mental health emergency, too often I saw my client sticking around waiting for a bed for them. That's wrong. The golden rule should apply in everything we do. And certainly, you know, in the past administration, it was terrible morally what we did to the mental health system and the consumers. And the other thing that doesn't get talked about a lot is I would hope that you would take care of the workers. The stress on those jobs is incredible. And every day I was faced with, you know, more need than I could meet, than the system could meet. And that takes a hell of a toll on the workers, too. So keep that in mind as well. Thanks.
That's a great suggestion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. We're going to go now to Ruth, who posted on Facebook, please ask the DHHS commissioner if she plans on reviewing the current system for reviewing elder abuse. Currently seems that only cases of physical abuse get attention, ignoring clear cases of emotional and financial abuse. There are many elders who live in fear daily and are too scared to speak up. Why are they interviewed in the presence of their abuser? This needs to change.
And I'm so glad that question got raised, because while we have been focused on the child protective services, the adult protective services workers are equally important to protecting vulnerable people in the state of Maine. We were just this morning talking about how do we do the same sort of process, which is first listen, what do these workers, what are they hearing, what are they seeing, going back to the canary in the coal mine, what are the problems we need to address? We know we already have an intake challenge, which is we're trying to make sure that the calls coming in and the system for making sure people get into this into our caseworkers is improved, but we certainly have more to do. And again, it's not just necessarily physical or mental abuse. Elder justice has to do with financial kind of security, all sorts of vulnerabilities that older Americans face. So we are certainly doing that. And I'll note, pulling back a little bit, that'll be part of a larger set of work that the department is undertaking, because Maine is the oldest state in the nation, and we have challenges as our older Americans are tipping over the age of 85. So we even have within our elderly population different groups with different needs. So we are going to try to convene stakeholders and experts in the month of May to kind of figure out what is our vision for where we want our long-term services and supports to be in 3 to 5 years. And part of that is keeping our seniors safe.
We'll go to Jeff, who's posting on Facebook. What is being done to address recruitment and retention issues for staff?
That is an excellent question. If anybody who's listening has great ideas, feel free to send them our way, because Maine is a low unemployment state, and we're competing in the Department of Health and Human Services with all other industries for highly qualified workers. So in addition to trying to just fill the vacancies that we have, and I am actually doing personal calls to recruit people these days, we also are looking at what type of technological supports we can create to make the work that a person does more highly skilled, so they're really focusing on what they can do well and can do best and a machine can't do for them. Similarly, how do we use operational changes, changing the workflow? So again, we need not more people, but we have highly trained people who are doing work more efficiently so that they really can achieve our mission. And last but not least, you know, we now have call center technology that is not the same old terrible get on the phone and wait for a long period of time. Can we use smart, you know, call centers and other sort of other supports to make there be equal numbers of people with more support so we can really recruit and retain high quality workers? Last thing I'll say is retention seems really important. We don't like high turnover, and too often, I think somebody mentioned earlier, morale. My goal is to make the department a good place to work, a supportive place to work, to make sure we're caring for the stress of our workers. So once we get somebody, that person wants to stay.
We'll go to Carrie, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Carrie. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I am also the executive director for Maine Parent Federation, and I have two children myself with disabilities. And I heard the commissioner reference the PCG report, which I'm familiar with. And I just wanted to encourage the commissioner to include parents and families within the stakeholder group when discussing the priorities of that PCG report. And just encourage that it not just be a token shift, that the family voices be equal, because they're the members who are living it on a daily basis, day in and day out. And the systems of care that families have to navigate for their children with special health care needs are very confusing here in the state of Maine, and a lot of times they're not included in decisions that affect their everyday life. So I just wanted to encourage that Family Voice be a part of that stakeholder discussion. Thank you.
And thank you. And we certainly will make sure. I think this happened already. We'll double down on that. One other point I'll clarify is that we've actually had two different reports related to children. One is related to the welfare system. The other, I think, is the one you're referring to, is about the children's behavioral health system, which is equally important. Again, children with complex healthcare needs, behavioral healthcare needs, who need special services. We have a whole list of actions we need to take to improve that system, and we're on it.
All right. Thanks for your call, Carrie. We are going to take another quick break. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Diversions Puzzles and Games, committed to offering fun, social, and technology-free ways to connect at Hannaford Plaza by Maine Mall and diversionsgames.com. Central Maine Healthcare's Maine Urgent Care, providing treatment for minor illnesses and injuries, now at the Topsom Fair Mall and maineurgentcare.com. And Colby College, presenting Guillermo Gomez Peña's solo performance, The Most Undocumented Mexican Artist, Tuesday, April 9th, colby.edu.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Preet Bharara, the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, talks about the consequences of not returning President Trump's phone calls, the Mueller report, and civic responsibility. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Congress in the Trump Era, we talk with Jake Sherman and Anna Palmer, who co-write Politico's newsletter Playbook and have written a new book called The Hill to Die On, The Battle for Congress and the Future of Trump's America. Join us.
You can hear Fresh Air this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are speaking with DHHS Commissioner Jean Lambrew. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. With us now, Bob Fowler, who is Executive Director of Milestone Recovery. Thanks for calling in, Bob, and tell us what Milestone Recovery does.
Well, Milestone Recovery works in the areas of addiction and in homelessness. So we're located in Portland and Old Orchard Beach, and very briefly, we do residential treatment, homeless outreach. We provide a homeless emergency services, shelter services, recovery housing, and a medical detox program.
We talked earlier about Maine Care expansion. What are you concerned about with its implementation?
Well, I've been thrilled about Maine Care expansion, really excited to see so many more people have health insurance now than who had it before. When we look at in our detox program, what we've seen historically in the last number of years is that the majority of clients coming through the Milestone Detox haven't had health insurance. So at the point that they were discharged, it made them very difficult. It made it very difficult for them to get into treatment and to sustain their recovery. And that picture has changed now. So the majority of the clients coming through the detox have health insurance, which is great, and many are interested in being referred on to the next level of care to sustain their recovery. The challenge that we're running into is that Maine's treatment system has really been sort of shrunken and depleted over the past number of years. So now these newly insured individuals are often encountering wait lists wherever it is we're referring them to. So the question that I have to Commissioner Lambrew is what her thoughts are and ideas are on how we can create more capacity in the system so we can have open doors when people are ready to enter treatment.
Sure. I think as part of the assessment I mentioned earlier that's going to be looking at our mental health system, we are looking at behavioral health and substance use disorders. They are different. They're not exactly the same, but many of the same people have problems that are related. So we want to make sure that we're looking at both. So we certainly are taking a good hard look at the capacity. Are there, you know, clinics, treatment options, residential sites? Where there's not, how do we create them? And where there are, how do we make sure we appropriately staff them? Because one of the things we've heard is that Maine has a fair amount of capacity, but doesn't necessarily have the staff to fill the beds in the residential settings or treat the people in community-based settings. So we're looking hard at that question with the optimism that when you look at what's happened in different states that have expanded Medicaid, the resources, because in the Medicaid expansion, at least 90% of the cost is paid for by the federal government, which means we really can spread resources in a way that we hadn't been able to previously. The state of West Virginia just recently reported that its expansion allowed them to increase the rate of use of medication-assisted treatment by 75%, increase the average duration of people in treatment from 161 days to 185 days, and increase counseling, because we don't want to just be providing people with medication. We want to make sure that they have the support for recovery. And that doesn't count the fact that with Maine Care expansion, you're not just providing one or two services, you're providing a comprehensive set of services. Because, again, a lot of these people have other sorts of health problems that when you get them the wraparound services, it makes them more likely to be in recovery and to succeed in independence and healthier lives.
Thanks, Bob, for calling in. Bob Fowler with Milestone Recovery. We have an email from Karen. What is the department's plan for rebuilding our public health nursing program, specifically in light of our state having the highest rates of pertussis in the nation and a non-medical opt-out rate triple the national average? How can we use public health nurses to get our vaccination rates where they need to be?
Sure. One of our priorities is rebuilding that public health nursing program. As I mentioned earlier, we are hiring, and we're, you know, 9 up, and we have some more to go. We're also changing its structure so it reports directly to the head of the CDC, that we're reviewing how it interacts with home visitation programs so we have more connectivity to the other types of home visitors. And we also, going to the question of pertussis, the public health nurses describe their job as being able to go to schools to educate, you know, nurses and students about the importance of vaccination, to be able to go to homes and educate new parents, to be able to react to public health emergencies. They love the variety of the job, so we're trying to rebuild that program, recognizing what's good about public health nurses is their versatility. Going to the issue of vaccinations, we did just release this week a report from our CDC, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, that was disturbing. It did show that the immunization rate among school-aged children continued to decrease. We're now below what's called herd immunity, meaning that if you have 95% of people in a community immunized, it protects those few who are not from spread from disease spreading from person to person. And the percentage of kindergarten exemptions from vaccination are now at an all-time high. So I think we're supportive, and the governor has expressed her support as well, of LD 798, which is a bill that would seek to remove these exemptions, which will improve our public health of our communities.
We'll go to Steve, who's calling from Old Town. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, so first I just wanted to thank the commissioner and also the governor for a clear picture of what they're going to do, and their fast action. That, to me, is very important. It's, you know, I don't want to put politics in, but that's what I voted for. And so I appreciate it. And in my sense of this is I see the people that work in the commissioner's purview as, you know, as important as public responders, as nurses and doctors. They do extremely important work. And I think they don't get the credit. And that's my fault. And to say that I appreciate the work they've done. Is it perfect? No. But I think we just need to take that mode that it, you know, it costs what it costs. You know, I'm not, I mean, unlimited, but we need to, because the lives of people are at their, you know, how we respond
how they respond, how we work together, how communities champion what they're doing, we're going to have even a better state. So I appreciate the effort that started. I hope that the morale, as people talk about, improves. I know that people, you know, they pick their profession, I think, because they want to help people. And I think that that's a high standard that we need to celebrate. And I appreciate their work that they do. So that's just a comment. Thank you very much for what you're doing so far.
Steve, thanks for your call.
And I will just say thank you, because I have been so impressed by the people that I have met day in, day out in the department who do come at it with that kind of public service commitment. And it's interesting because I think on Friday is the governor's 100th day in office. And so we all have been looking back, because usually you do nothing but look at the problem of the day and where we're going. But in looking back, I think we feel good about the work that we've begun. That includes activities from the main care expansion to strengthening public health to tackling the opioid crisis, which I think Gordon Smith has been on this show and talked about previously. Certainly addressing the mental health and behavioral health challenges we've heard about, and child and welfare services. I would mention that one of the first bills that the governor signed was LD1, which is a bill that's called an Act to Protect Healthcare Coverage for Maine Families, because part of what we have to do here in Maine is protect the state and its residents from potential threats coming from Washington. And there is a big lawsuit called Texas versus U.S. that would, if the Supreme Court upholds the challenge, strip away all the consumer protections that were in the Affordable Care Act for people with pre-existing conditions. It would take away the ability for adults to cover their parents to cover their adult children on their health insurance policy. It would bring it back lifetime and annual caps on coverage. And one of the good things about being in a state like Maine is that the governor of the legislature decided, let's do what we can to prevent that from happening here. And they put into state law all these consumer protections that will not fully but largely protect a lot of people in Maine should there be rollbacks of consumer protections in Washington, D.C.
We'll go to Maria calling from Augusta. Hi, Maria. Go ahead. You're on Maine calling with Commissioner Jean Lambrew.
Thank you. I remember watching a movie where the father was disabled. I can't remember exactly. Maybe I don't know if it was mental or just physical disability. And he had a child, maybe year old. And one of the things that they wanted to take the child to put him in foster care. And he says, what about if we had foster care for the family? And, it stuck with me. And I think, you know, one of the things, I mean, we have foster care, and there's a lot of problems with that when they may not be very successful. So I wonder if that would be something that could be put into the background to investigate. It would be possible to have someone go in the family and help them learn and help with the, have a better family situation.
Maria, thank you.
Yeah, I think the idea of supporting families, you know, including families with people with disabilities, is absolutely a priority. Our Dr. Landry, when he arrives, will make sure he looks specifically at this idea. And I will say more broadly, we want to make sure that we're supporting our foster care families. That is a concern that we have heard since we've arrived, is that we don't provide sufficient support for those families so they, too, can do a good job in helping that parent like the one that this that you mentioned. So thank you very much for that suggestion.
Maria, thanks for your call. Piper writes on Facebook, I don't know if this falls in Commissioner Lambrew's realm, but I'm very concerned about the non-compliance of businesses and installations of devices which help disabled and elderly to be able to function, such as handlebars and restrooms and easier entrance access with safety in mind for these folks. It's as though many businesses don't think of these people as valid patrons.
So I think it partly falls within our purview, although I will say every single day I discover something new that we're responsible for at the Department of Health and Human Services. It's a very, very big department. We are responsible when it comes to residential care facilities for people with developmental disabilities or intellectual disabilities or those sorts of services. So we're actually implementing improvements in our standards and support not just improvement in standards, but help. So those types of places that are small, that are serving some of our vulnerable population, have help with that. I don't think that we do public spaces like restaurants or other places. That's subject, I think, to the Americans with Disability Act. But we certainly, within our own universe of places that we're monitoring, appreciate the fact that we must make sure that they are accessible for all people.
All right. We'll go to Gary, who's calling from Rockland. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Hello. I have a very specific question. I've been involved with a situation. I'm not family, but I know a family that has had a little boy, and he's been terribly traumatized and hurt. And the question I have, and I know a woman who's a therapist who specializes in children and trauma, and she's never heard of a worse case of not being able to help this child. I know there's details and, you know, much that I can't tell you about or, you know, not time for, but the specific question is what can happen? Who can be called when it is harmful, when it's a really dire situation? This was one of those, and nothing happened. Even the police were involved, and it never it just went on for years, and this child was harmed. As the years went by, the harm accumulated. So
Gary, this is a family that has called, or the friends and family have called police?
Actually, this situation did involve that. The mother of the boy hurt this boy, and police came and took statements, but nothing happened. The same woman
Okay,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, we're just near the end of the program. So, Commissioner Lambert, I want to give you a chance to respond.
Sure. I can't speak to this specific case, but can say, and say this to anybody who's listening, on our home site, on our website, Department of Health and Human Services, Maine Department of Health and Human Services, there is a click to hotlines and how to get help. Reporting is essential. One of the things that we've seen, especially with child welfare, is while the Department of Health and Human Services has mandatory reporting requirements for certain types of, you know, people who come into contact with kids, it takes a community to make sure that those children are protected and safe. And that does mean reporting. We need to have people in our system to make sure that we can get them there. So anybody who has suspicion, please use our website to find the right hotline, and we'll hopefully get you that help.
Gary, thank you so much for calling, and good luck. I hope the situation improves. Commissioner Lambrew, thank you so much for joining us here on Maine Calling today. Commissioner Jean Lambrew leads Maine's Department of Health and Human Services. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Isaac Merson took your calls. Dan Works gave us additional technical help. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8. It is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Thursday, Maine Calling will broadcast live from the Gracie Theater at Husson University. We'll be talking about entrepreneurship. You are welcome to come be part of the audience. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.